Tonight I thought I'd talk about how to govern the mind, how to govern your mind. And I'm using that word govern strategically, as you'll see as I give tonight's talk. So, just like for a long time people mistakenly thought that the sun revolves around the earth, and they mistakenly thought that the earth was flat, because that's the way it appeared at first sight, people mistakenly believe that there's a single identity or soul or personality or thing inside of their minds that gives them this core self. And actually, as the Buddha taught, and as Freud and other psychologists taught, and as other psychiatrists and psychology theory, and as modern neuroscience is all now finally proved beyond any doubt, there is no core thing in the brain that gives us a personality. When you in fact look at the brain, there's many, many different subsystems, none of which is always on. In fact, your brain is made up of many subsystems that turn off and on given certain situations and circumstances and events and agendas. And so, while it seems like you have a coherent personality, in fact, you don't. You don't even have a consciousness that's always on, even though it appears to be. When, if you look at good books on that sort of summarize modern neuroscience, I was looking at one last night by a woman, a science writer named Susan Blackmore, a British scientist who writes on neuroscience. She wrote a book, I think, called Mapping the Mind. And she talked about all the different subsections that go on and off that create the members of our mind. I'll list just some of them just so you get an idea of the breadth and variety. You've got a part of the mind that's responsible for creating fear in your body, the amygdala. Then there's body craving, the hypothalamus. There's the people pleaser part of your brain that worries about whether other people will like you and how to make yourself socially acceptable. That's the orbital frontal region. There's the creative, playful, non-linguistic part of the brain. That's the right cerebral cortex. Then there's the logical reasoning in the left ventral medial axis. There's the emotional language. When we get all upset and emotional, that's the dorsolateral. And then there's the habitual ideas and actions. That's the striatum. And then there's the focus and attention and mental energy, the cingulate. So there's a lot of different members in that governing body. I like to think of it as a European parliament. If you follow European parliaments, there's one thing you'll notice is that they're made up of coalitions. And sometimes the coalitions last for a while, and sometimes they fall apart. It's the same thing with a coalition in the mind. Generally, there's not any one single part of the brain on and dominating. They form coalitions. For example, if you're frightened or worried about something at work, like whether you're going to get fired or something like that, you might expect the amygdala to freak out the body, and you might expect the dorsolateral to start sending thoughts of, oh God, what do I do? How will I pay the rent? And the cingulate might be on, energizing the mind and releasing acetylcholine. So there's a lot of dopamine flowing around there, adrenaline and cortisol stress. So that's one coalition. But another coalition might be you come to Dharma Punks and you see somebody who looks cool, looks good, attractive. Somebody you think, oh, they're sort of good looking. So in that situation, an entirely different set of coalitions is turned on. You might have your hypothalamus, which creates a little bit of craving. You might release a little bit of dopamine. You might have a little bit of the ventral, middle, and the left part of the brain that would be thinking of lines, like what could I say that might get them interested in me? So, and then you might have the reward dopamine release. So, different coalitions. And the coalitions can shift very quickly when we're not, when something happens, for example, outside in the world. Use an example. Before 9/11, Bush was a very unpopular president. Right after 9/11, when the planes flew into the building, suddenly Bush's approval rating went from the 30s to the 80s. He really didn't do very much that warranted it, but it was simply that when the American population and the government felt we were under attack, suddenly these base emotional events occurred that galvanized people to rally around at that what was up to that point an unpopular president. Just so we can be in our lives, chugging away in your computer, and then somebody can say to you, hey, I'd like to talk to you in my office on Monday morning. Well, then you're fucked, right? Then, then you've got suddenly a peaceful mind state is completely disrupted by suddenly fear in the body, fear in the mind, worry, envisioning all the bad scenarios, the temporal lobe gets involved. So you've suddenly got a whole new coalition because of an external event. The same thing can happen with a big idea. In 1932 or 33, I believe it was, FDR sold to the American population what was called the New Deal, which was a whole bunch of programs aimed to help the poor and give people jobs and support the arts. These were ideas that up until a few years before him had absolutely no support, or nobody even thought of them. But suddenly, a few years into the Deep Depression, people became willing to hear a new idea. Likewise, when we are depressed ourselves and then suddenly the idea comes, or we're in addiction, and suddenly the idea comes, well, maybe I should stop doing this to myself, or maybe I don't have to suffer and get stressed out. Maybe I should learn to meditate. So we galvanize around this big idea. Now, some of these coalitions last for a while. For some reason, I wish I could give the definitive action, the far right tends to build coalitions that are stronger in this country than the progressive left. I guess because the far right tends to sell their ideas based on fear and greed, whereas the left tends to appeal to more intellectual and empathetic and more refined appeals. So the baser, more greed-based, more self-centered, more fear-oriented coalitions have more power. Thus so in our own minds is the same case. When we're frightened or worried about something, we can be in those states for a very long time. When we're angry, we can be angry and obsessed with anger for a long time. But when we have good ideas, like, ooh, maybe I should practice gratitude or generosity or goodwill, those ideas don't often last very long. Just a wrong remark or a glance we don't like or an event that triggers economic worry or fear of the future will completely wipe away all that generosity and goodwill, and we're back in the right-wing coalition of fear in our brain. So part of the trick of learning how to govern your brain is, the first is to learn which parts of your mind you can't reason with. Use an example. There are certain Republicans, I guess, that are reasonable. Haven't met them, but I'm sure they're there. On the other hand, I would not spend any of my life trying to sell a progressive policy to a Tea Party member. It would be a waste of time. Thus, so there are parts of the brain, for instance, fear, worry, worst-case scenarios, that are primarily motivated by very, very old types of the brain that cannot be reasoned with. You have to simply see, oh, this is fear, hello. But wasting your time trying to push it away or argue with it is not going to work. It's like trying to convince Sarah Palin that it's good to care about the environment. Not going to happen. So why are you wasting your efforts? Same thing with the mind. Trying to reassure the extreme obsessive fear parts of the brain in normal ways don't work. There are, luckily, ways I'll talk about that do work. So it's interesting that when we meditate, you can watch how long a coalition will last and then see your own mind, the coalition, disintegrate, and watch as your mind floats away from the breath and the body and keeping yourself relaxed and goes back into work or to tomorrow or to a relationship that's not going too well or to a family situation. So the mind's coalition to focus and relax is disrupted. Just so you can have new presidents and new bodies of government elected, and for a little while they stay with the task at hand, and then suddenly, before you know it, they're all just shattered and disintegrated and going off on their own little agendas to try to appease their own self-interest in their own areas that they represent. Well, that's what happens with the mind. So there are strategies to govern the mind. The first is, when you're in an obsessive state, or by which I mean a repeating state that won't go away, that's causing suffering, the first thing to do is to split apart the coalition. You don't try to tackle them all at once. You try to see what are the members of the coalition in your mind that are making you suffer. And you work with each to get them to splinter so that they don't work together so well anymore. I'll give you an example. Suppose you're worried about a relationship or worried about a situation at your work or worried about something going on with a friend or a roommate that's bugging you. And the thoughts are repeating and also the body is stressed out. Really stressed out. So the Buddha taught through mindfulness, the first thing to do was always go to the body. That's the most difficult and most entrenched. But if you work with that first and you relax it, you throw it a bone, you say, now we're going to take care of you, angry body, worried body. We're going to breathe. We're going to sit comfortably. We're going to make sure you're feeling good. We're going to not ignore you. We're going to take care of you. Once you've got the body a little less worked up, then you can work on the mind, just the mind, see if the mind is really anxious and jumping around, or does it feel claustrophobic? And again, you can use the breath, as we did in that meditation, to bring energy if the mind is too sluggish or too calm the mind if the mind is jumping all around. You can also use the breath and make it big to enlighten the mind if it feels claustrophobic and small. And then when it comes to the thoughts, with the thoughts, the Buddha said, don't argue with them and don't try to push them away. The skillful thing to do is to notice first what the thought is and see clearly if it's skillful or unskillful, if it's appropriate in the situation or it's not. Now, every type or part of the brain has a reason for being. Even the most fearful part of the mind is there to help us. For instance, if we're being attacked by a bear, you'd want to have fear. You'd want to have your amygdala. If you're about to be in an accident or if somebody's about to attack you or whatever, you'd want to have an amygdala. Unfortunately, the amygdala was far more appropriate to the way the world was when it was created. when the mind was set in place 40,000 years ago, when you could be killed any moment. Now we've got amygdalas or fear centers that are far more active than they need to be. Instead of worrying about tigers that are about to eat us or bears, they're looking at roommates as threats. They're looking at co-workers who play their music a little too loud or ask us questions that we don't want to hear or whatever as threats, like they're bears or wild boars or runaway cows or whatever. Actually, the Buddha, actually, in a lot of the Pali Canon, the Buddha talks about people getting killed by runaway cows, so I gather that was actually that always comes to mind. So once we see that a thought is fear, we don't argue with it, we don't push it away, we don't belittle it. Because I said again that every part of the brain has a reason for being, it's just they generally fire for reasons that are not legitimate. Very often there's a part of the brain like the striatum, the habit part, that kicks in even then when we shouldn't be falling into our habits. Or the hypothalamus gets us craving and worked up about a sale, even though the item started up more expensively than the sale reduces the price to be. So we trigger the mind, trigger parts of the mind, even when we shouldn't be. So when we see that a thought is unskillful, what we do, we say hello to it, we don't give it any energy, we don't give it the microphone on the floor of the house in our brain, or the parliament in our minds. We instead switch, because we are, after all, the part that is aware is the strongest part of the mind. So we have actually the ability to, especially after we practice meditation, to refocus from an unskillful thought. Once we see it's unskillful, we can focus on a quieter, less loud part of the mind. Even the most worried person, if you talk calmly to them and you say, hey, it's going to be okay, I'll be there with you, we'll get through this together, you can reach beyond their fear into a voice or a part of the mind that is searching for help, is looking for acknowledgement. There's that part of your mind, too, that's always there. Even though fear or anger or worry might be screaming in your brain, there still is quieter voices that you can put the spotlight on. Buddha said in right effort, it's finding skillful voices in the mind and amplifying them, or B, if there are no skillful voices that you can hear, then elect one. You can actually, like a president appointing Supreme Court judge, you can appoint an emergency member of your parliament. You can say, oh shit, I'm filled with worry, I'm going to elect gratitude into my brain. And I'm going to guess what gratitude would say right now if he were around. What would gratitude say if I'm worried about getting fired? Well, he would say, well, I'm grateful that I have, you know, accomplished these skills and these friendships and that I'm doing these skillful things in my life, and I would see that in the past I've somehow managed to survive. I've rarely wound up homeless. So we practice bringing about gratitude and generosity. And again, the key, though, is when you see a voice is unskillful, don't waste your time arguing with it. It's most of the time not going to respond to logic. It's not going to respond to being pushed away. But if you purposely say, okay, I'm going to find the exact opposite of what this voice is saying, and I'm going to give equal time, at the very least, to a voice that I know is skillful, already you're beginning to break apart the coalition. It's very important, I'm just looking to make sure I've covered everything. It's very important, I'll close with, not to practice beating up yourself in life. Because beating up yourself, harshly judging yourself, telling long stories, calling yourself names, or deciding that you're not good enough, or that you're not capable, or whatever it is, all the thinking does is empower the worst, most unskillful parts of the mind that are the least governable. You're just giving more energy to fear, to doubt, to worry, to jadedness, to whatever you call or you notice as those parts of the mind that really believe you're safest by just giving up and believing you're not going to get any of your needs met, that you won't be taken care of. So when you meditate, when you practice anything spiritual, the key is to cultivate the kind of coalition and voices that you want to empower. Finally, it's really important to learn how to sell skillfulness to your own mind. Just as Lyndon Johnson, was a stretch, but Lyndon Johnson started out as a very conservative Democrat, but he was, after he wound up as president when Kennedy was shot, he actually managed to sell through an idea that was called the Great Society, and where he had this war on poverty, and where pretty much the last really great movement in the country towards progressive policies were enacted. I mean, he was by no means a leftist, but he actually passed a number of very far-sighted bills. And he didn't sell, though, this great society by saying, oh, look at this wonderful idea. Everybody who is poor or being abused or who is being put down because of their race or anything like that, we will try to empower them. He didn't appeal to people's intellect. He actually very cleverly sold this idea to the more conservative parts of the government by saying, look, there's rioting going on in the streets of L.A., Newark, Detroit. If you don't want the entire country to go up in flames, you better start passing some progressive bills. And for a while, the middle of the country said, fuck yeah. I don't want to have my streets go up in riots. I'm scared. Okay, if you think this will work, I'll try this. Didn't last very long. Nixon wound up as the president very soon, but at least that's the idea. If you want to sell meditation to yourself, you don't only try, oh, it's a good thing. Good, you know, meditation, yeah, reduces stress, and you also sell it to yourself, to the fear parts of your mind, by saying, hey, remember the last time we were really fucked up and worried and with insomnia? You want that again? You want to sit in your you want us to sit in that worry and that self-centered spiral of doubt forever? So we practice spinning meditation and generosity and goodwill and gratitude so that there are ideas that we'll want to pursue. Because I guarantee you, the ideas that we'll naturally gravitate towards are self-centered, fear-driven greed. That's the way the mind is set up to follow. But luckily, we're not one thing. We have many different members in the mind. And because we are not one thing, because the mind has got many different members, guess what? We can change. We can grow. We can become happier, more relaxed, more peaceful people. We just have to learn how to govern the mind. And that's tonight's talk. So thanks for listening.